two Jacksonville high schools remain closed through the rest of the month and all virtual due to outbreaks of coronavirus. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, your questions answered about those school closures around town and thoughts about the virus in general and how we're managing it around the region. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, our ADAPT Summit series this week looks at the threats to the St. John's River. We'll have a preview of that. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID numbers. We need to let you know that Florida's daily report on the coronavirus was delayed Wednesday. The Florida Department of Health released a statement saying it's changing how it investigates fatalities due to COVID. The numbers normally come out for all of us to relay to you around 11 a.m., but yesterday they didn't go out till after 5 p.m. They showed 105 new deaths around the state. The total death toll from the virus in Florida now stands at 16,210. Florida also reported 2,145 new positive cases of COVID. That brings the total to date to 762,534. Now, this change in reporting comes as families around town continue to deal with the temporary closure of two local schools, brick and mortar closure, we need to note, only due to outbreaks of the virus. Both Fletcher High School and the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts will remain closed through the rest of the month. DCPS, Duval County Public Schools, says they really had no choice but to shift these schools to virtual learning because of the percentage of positive cases at those schools. We're getting an update right now, and we're pleased to welcome Elizabeth Trisotto, the Director of School Health Services for the Duval County Public Schools. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And also with us, Dr. Sunil Joshi, president of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation. Dr. Joshi, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Already getting your calls about the temporary closures of Fletcher and DA. It's 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open. Elizabeth Trisotto, you direct school health services for Duval County Public Schools. Can you bring us up to date on what you're looking at when it comes to the temporary closures of Fletcher at the Beaches and the Magnet Performing School, the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts?
Yes, ma'am. So in order to come up with that determination, we are looking at the closing procedures, and according to our closing procedures matrix, 20% of the school reporting exposures to COVID-19 would make that decision. And what that means is when we are aware of any positive case at the school, we immediately report that to the Florida Department of Health, and they do a contact investigation. Based on the outcome of that contact investigation, they determine who's had prolonged direct contact with that positive case. When we have multiple cases involved at a particular school, such as Fletcher and Douglas Anderson, the amount of exposures increased greatly due to the number of cases, and so when we were getting close to that 20% threshold or greater, the decision was made to transition the schools to virtual learning.
Okay, so this is through Halloween, and then in November, do you expect to go back to 5-day-a-week brick-and-mortar class?
Yes, ma'am. The decision will then be to transition the students back to in-person instruction after they've completed the 14-day quarantine period as recommended by the Florida Department of Health.
Okay, thanks for that update. Dr. Joshi, the school district is simply following health department guidelines, the state's own guidelines. So it was remarkable the other day to see Governor Ron DeSantis come to town and speak at a charter school and say he didn't think schools should close for any circumstance in this pandemic. He was not even aware that as he was literally making those remarks, local school officials had to make this move. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, that honestly, that was somewhat disappointing to hear from the governor. And it does seem like maybe he wasn't briefed appropriately about what was happening here in Duval County, in particular with some of our bigger public schools. But it's also somewhat misguided because, some of his, he had mentioned that, well, we know that kids are not carriers or kids do not get sick from COVID-19. And again, we know that that's not entirely true. We know that kids do certainly spread the virus amongst each other, in particular if they're not social distancing or wearing masks. And they definitely can spread it to their parents or grandparents or other children who may be sick and have other health conditions. And so, so absolutely the schools here locally have done the right thing by closing the school for Fletcher and Douglas Anderson for the next week or so, so that they can try to get these positive tests down.
And Elizabeth, we hear in the case of Fletcher that the virus might have spread by some kids having a gathering, a party off campus. I don't know that for sure. But you can't control what the students do outside of school. You can control what happens in the school buildings, though.
That's correct. I think that the school district has done an amazing job implementing multiple mitigating strategies to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in the school district. But as you stated earlier, unfortunately, we cannot control what happens outside of the schools. And so we encourage everyone to practice what's being practiced in the schools, to wear a mask outside of school, to socially distance, to wash your hands, and monitor for symptoms of COVID, both in and outside of the school.
Let's go to some calls now, 549-2937, as we talk about the temporary closures of Fletcher High School and Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. Kids are quarantining there after a cluster of cases at both schools reached above 20% of the total student body. Katie is on the west side. Hi, Katie. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Yeah. So I just sent my two younger kids back to school after being out for a week with a cold. Tested negative for COVID twice. And about 20 minutes ago, I got a call from my son's high school. He's at Paxson. Very urgent calls that he has been exposed to COVID at Paxson. Can't get back through to administration, so I imagine they're making a lot of calls right now. So kind of concerned.
Yeah, sure. So did they say that your son needed to quarantine at home?
I haven't been able to reach them. They left voicemails. He texted me. He said, I need to come get him right now. I'm on my way. I assume he'll have to quarantine, and I will have to go pick up my kids from their first day back and keep them at home as well, my other ones.
I'm so sorry, Katie. I'm so sorry to hear that. Elizabeth, these are horrible choices for all of us at the district level, for teachers, for parents, all of us. And let me disclose, at my household, we have two children at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, both at home now. Everyone wants their kids in school. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But as you just heard from that caller, if a child has been exposed, and we're hearing this happened at Paxson, they have to bring the kid home. They have to quarantine. And that puts more stress on all of us.
Yes, ma'am. Unfortunately, due to us navigating during this pandemic, we work closely with the Florida Department of Health. And when there is someone identified as a positive case, whether that's an employee or a student, we do report that to the Florida Department of Health. And based on the outcome of their investigation, if they identify a student or another employee as a close contact, they will need to quarantine for a length of time that's determined by the Florida Department of Health. And typically that's for 14 days after that last date of direct contact.
Dr. Joshi, two new international studies show no consistent relationship between in-person K-12 schooling and the spread of coronavirus. So what is your position as head of the Duval County Medical Society on how Florida is handling this? For the most part, kids are back in brick-and-mortar school, although district officials will pump the brakes, as we're seeing, if there's an outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular, we've done a nice job here in Duval County at mitigating the spread of COVID-19. And so, yeah, I mean, if the children are wearing masks, if they're socially distant, if they're washing their hands, and you're doing all of the right things, then you can certainly mitigate the spread. And I think for the most part in Florida, we've done a decent job with that. However, having the flexibility to be able to shut down a school when there is a massive outbreak, like we have seen at Fletcher and to some extent at Douglas Anderson, is something that the school district should be allowed to do, because ultimately that's how we're going to truly mitigate the spread from in terms of it coming from the schools. And so I do feel like in the big picture, we've done a good job of keeping people safe and out of the hospital, but I'm also concerned because, you know, we tend to lag in our numbers compared to the rest of the country. And remember back in the spring, when the rest of the country was having many, many more positive tests and more issues with COVID, we seemed to be doing okay. And then in the summer, we were the ones that were having the issues. And I have a concern that that's going to happen if we go as we go forward, unless we are really, really taking these cases in schools seriously. Because if we do not shut down the schools that have more than 20% who need to quarantine, then I am concerned that we're going to see those numbers go up and we're going to see hospitalizations go up. So it is important that we follow the recommendations of the Department of Health and the leaders of our public school system.
It's 549-2937. Vince is in Neptune Beach. Hi, Vince. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a student myself, and I was just concerned about the accuracy of the temperature checks as soon as you get out of the car, because you would be blessed with air conditioning, and the surface of your skin would be a different temperature than your internal temperature.
Okay. Where do you go to school, Vince?
Kernan Middle.
Kernan Middle. All right, Vince, thanks for your call. Elizabeth Trisotto with DCPS, the temp checks, that's part of what students are submitting to as they enter campus. And can you tell us more about that? That student was wondering how accurate they are and how well they're working for the district.
Yeah, so the temperature checks done in the morning are a part of our screening process as far as any students that are entering in. We also have a screening tool that we have all of our employees follow where they check their symptoms daily. And we also ask that parents check their children daily prior to having them come to school and making sure that they are healthy and not exhibiting any symptoms of COVID that might be a concern for possible exposure to their other classmates or faculty members. And as far as the temperature checks, we do that daily at the schools. And then if any student is exhibiting any symptoms or is not feeling well, then they are brought to the clinic for an assessment. And
all right.
Making sure that they're okay.
Thanks for that. Claudia in Avondale. Hi, Claudia. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey. Yes, I have a son at Douglas Anderson who switched to Duval Homeroom, and it's because he was in a classroom with someone who had COVID. And I was looking at the new CDC guidelines that came out, I think it was yesterday, that determined the exposure as opposed to being like for an extended period of time without a mask. They're saying that it can be for small periods over an extended amount of time that can cause an exposure that needs to be quarantined. How is that going to be able to be impacted, and how do we determine things?
Yeah, Claudia, thank you so much for that. I feel your pain. Both of our kids are at DA, so we've got two doing virtual learning right now. And so, Dr. Joshi, can you explain about exposure? If you're around someone who's positive, how close you are and the amount of time you're around them make a difference, don't they?
They really do. You know, now you can be around somebody for just minutes and still pick up the virus, depending on whether or not that child or that person is symptomatic. Are they coughing? Are they sneezing in your face? You know, are you wearing masks? Are both people doing what they can to minimize the exposure? But typically speaking, you know, so you have to pick a time. You have to pick a certain period of time to say, okay, these people definitely need to be quarantined or need to be contact traced. And that 15-minute rule has been what has been suggested by the CDC over time. Now, that's all based on people who are not wearing masks and who are exposed to each other and people who are typically asymptomatic. If someone is having symptoms and they are having fevers or they're coughing or they're sneezing, then even casual exposure to that person can certainly cause an infection to spread. And so it really does depend on the situation. But we are assuming that children who come to school are not symptomatic because we're doing temperature checks. They have a checklist of questions to answer before they come to school, as Elizabeth had mentioned earlier. And we're hoping that our parents are responsible as they're sending their children to school so that they're asymptomatic. And in an asymptomatic situation, that's where that 15-minute rule comes into play. And I'll, for disclosure, my daughter this morning woke up with a sore throat, and we just were like, no, you can't go to school today. And so, I mean, you just have to be responsible as a parent so that we can get through all of this together.
Right. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Sunil Joshi, president of the Duval Medical Society. Elizabeth Trisotto directs the school health services for the Duval County Public Schools. Our guest right now, as we talk about the temporary closures of Fletcher and DA high schools, Felicia at the Beaches. Felicia, go ahead.
Hi. My concern is that even though we have rules at the school, such as wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart, all those things are almost impossible. Students are in the classroom. The shields are only two-sided. The masks are usually taken off or below their nose. In the hallway, students, you can't control them. Take the mask off again.
Are you a teacher? Are you a teacher, Felicia?
I'm not a teacher. I support schools.
Okay.
So I'm in a variety of schools, and so I observe. I'm in that place.
Yeah.
So with my double mask on and my shield, I see. And, I mean, I want students to be in school because I know how hard it is to be home, but I also see how the virus can easily spread, and I don't see how we can contact trace anybody because people are in the hallway, students are in the hallway all at the same time.
Okay, Felicia, thank you for that. Elizabeth Trisotto, you direct school health services for Duval County Public Schools. These are kids, they're minors. It's impossible to get them to follow the rules all of the time, I would guess. Can you talk a little bit about these concerns and what you're trying to do about that?
So our schools are doing a great job at implementing these mitigating strategies. I know that at the elementary school level, they've made fun games about hand washing and encouraging students to wear the face masks or face shields. And so they've done a really great job. And sometimes if students are not implementing those strategies, then certainly those conversations are had with those students.
Right. So you take them aside and say, look, you please try to adhere. You're not being punitive necessarily, but trying to enforce as best you can. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think this district's doing a great job. And this is a difficult time for everyone, but we really do appreciate, you know, all of the support that we've received from the faculty and from the students, as well as trying to implement these mitigating strategies.
And as Elizabeth will stick with us as we take a few more calls. Dr. Joshi, I know you have to see patients in a minute. What's your message to everyone out there who's monitoring this, especially all the parents and teachers?
Yeah, and I want to, give props to Elizabeth and her team, because I have two kids in public schools here in Duval County, and not one day have I felt like they're unsafe. I'll be honest with you. And so as the previous caller said, yes, you cannot control kids all the time, and you're going to have kids take off their mask or have it down below their nose, and all of that is true. What the DCPS is doing the best they can at mitigating the spread. They cannot prevent the spread, okay? Viruses like this are going to spread, but doing the best they can at keeping the spread from being at such a high level that we're closing down all of the schools is what they've been trying to do, and I feel like they've done a very good job with that. And you should feel comfortable with your kids in school at this point. And also, I think we should feel comfortable that the DCPS and the Department of Health, in particular, are going to try to do what's in the best interest of our children. Now, politicians may not always be doing that, but I feel very strongly that the Department of Health and DCPS are protecting our kids and teachers, and we should follow their guidance as we go forward. If we can do that, I think we'll have a successful school year, keep people out of the hospital, and hopefully safe. And also get your flu shot. Please get the
flu shot. Yes, yes. Thanks for that. Dr. Sunil Joshi, who heads up the Duval County Medical Society Foundation, has to jump off the line. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Let's get a couple more calls on the air. Brian is in Ortega. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to give your panel a second chance to answer that middle schooler's question about the temperature checks and the kids coming out of the car with the AC on. I think they did a good job of describing the protocol, but I'm not sure that the kid got a direct answer on whether
his question as to whether it's getting an accurate read of the temperature?
Yes, that was pretty much his question.
Okay. Elizabeth, if you could respond to that caller.
Sure. So as far as the temperature checks go, like I mentioned before, we encourage everyone to check their children's temperature prior to coming to school or at least doing a symptom check on them. And if the temperature is checked at the school a few minutes after they've just come out of the air conditioning, then we would, if they ended up developing any symptoms during the day, certainly go ahead and recheck their temperature.
Okay. And if a kid is getting out of the car in a AC, in an air-conditioned car, does that make a difference in there? Would that temporarily dampen down their temperature?
It could potentially dampen down their temperature, but if they were having a fever, then we would certainly pick that up while they were at school. And that's why we encourage everyone to check their child prior to having them either come on the school bus or come to school in the morning. So that way we can prevent them from coming to school if they are symptomatic.
All right. One more call. It's Carolina on the South Side. Hi, Carolina. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for taking my call. As you know, you might remember, I'm a local pediatrician. I have two comments on the temperature. I have a comment and a question on the temperature checks. You know, some schools are only doing temperature checks multiple times a day, not masking, not shielding, and that's concerning to me, especially when they're in middle and high school. Those are private schools. By the time you get a temperature, you've been contagious probably at least 24 hours to 48 hours, so that's my one comment, and it could happen in school because people are feeling very comfortable that, oh, there are no cases, so we don't have to track them at home. Honestly, people don't really take their temperatures at home. That's from what my feedback is that I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
The second question is actually, what are there criteria for the private schools to follow these recommendations, or can they do just, you know, they can make whatever plan they want to do without having to follow the CDC recommendations for masking.
Yeah, so Carolina, thanks for that. You know, there is a mask order still in effect throughout the county for all buildings, whether they're private or not. But Elizabeth, what are your final thoughts about her points and anything else you can share with us?
Sure. So the private schools are allowed to follow their own guidance, and we certainly recommend following any guidance that comes from the Centers for Disease Control or any recommendations provided from the Florida Department of Health in order to provide those mitigating strategies to prevent the spread. And that's ultimately our goal, is to prevent any further spread of disease in the school district and continue to closely work with the Florida Department of Health in order to help hopefully mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in the school district.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Trisotto has a tough job right now. She's the Director of School Health Services for the Duval County Public Schools. Thanks for the update on this busy day for you. We'll hopefully check in with you again soon, Elizabeth.
Great. Thank you again for having me. You have a great rest of your day.
You as well. Much more still ahead, meanwhile. Later, it's a brand new leader at the city's Performers Academy. We'll speak with Ebony Payne English. But up next.
And what they do at the clinic is treat veterans and others with PTSD, and they use a therapy called a ketamine IV drip therapy.
It's innovative help for troubled and suicidal veterans. We'll speak with the CEO of Once a Soldier after this.
You blink, you reach for that handful of chips, you scroll through social media, it's all happening on automatic pilot. When it comes to being well-informed, being more mindful of where you get your news can make a big difference in how you see the world. To get your information in context, to gain different perspectives, and to understand real issues, choose NPR as your go-to source for election news. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Here on WJCT News 89.9. Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, a free and a socially distanced outdoor forum is coming up this weekend in St. Augustine. Lots of information will be presented to help veterans and their families around the region who cope with high rates of suicide and PTSD. I got a preview from Dave Barbush. He is CEO of Once a Soldier. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Good to have you on as we talk about this ongoing public health issue, veteran suicides, and all the work you're doing through your organization, Once a Soldier. You've got an event coming up, a discussion about PTSD, all of the issues veterans are facing, and this will be outdoors and socially distanced. So tell us a little bit about what you're planning.
Well, it's called Positive Progress, and it is on October 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in St. Augustine at the Gourmet Hut, which is an outdoor venue, as you said. And I'm hoping, and I've structured it in a way so that it, I think it's a well-rounded discussion about this issue. So we have Representative Rutherford coming, and he's always been a champion for this. He was on the SVAC, the Senate Veterans, I'm sorry, the House Veterans Affairs Committee. He's no longer on that, but he's well versed in this issue and is doing his best. So we'll hear from him. We'll hear from a local PTSD clinic called Sunbelt Wellness, and that will be Brian Hogan, who is the director of that clinic. And what they do at the clinic is treat veterans and others with PTSD, and they use a therapy called a ketamine IV drip therapy, and it shows clinical off the charts, very effective, reducing depression, and the PTSD scores come down from about 90 to a more manageable sort of quote-unquote average score of about 30. And then we'll have as our third speaker Kevin Johns, who lost his son to veteran suicide due to PTSD actually 2 years ago on 9/11. So hopefully those that are interested are going to get a very well-rounded education and information about what's going on, how it affects, you know, everyday Americans that do send their sons off to war, and what's being done locally and on a national level to not only stop veteran suicide, but to take care of the families after that. That's our big issue is, in the world of postvention, once prevention fails, and we know that it fails roughly 22 times a day, that's 20 families thrown into absolute crisis and horrific conditions, and we're not really, as a nation, taking care of them yet, and that's where our nonprofit steps in.
That's where you step in. I want to circle back to what you mentioned about the presentation people will hear about ketamine. Veterans are just coming home from Europe and the Middle East with horrific issues. They're bipolar, they have PTSD, suicidal ideation, because they see things and experience things that are so horrific. But ketamine, we are hearing more and more about how it can really make a difference with severely depressed or troubled people. Can you share a little bit more about how ketamine works with some of the veterans that are getting this form of treatment?
Sure. First of all, you're right. It's a psychedelic, which is kind of one of the, you know, right now that's great, but there's still a lot of warming up to do to that notion. But the way that it works is, first of all, ketamine kind of got a bad rap because of the party drug Special K, which abused it. Right. But ketamine is in every hospital, in every medical center across the country, because it is what puts you to sleep when you for anesthesia, when you have surgery. That we have trained and licensed clinicians that are ready to administer this, and what they're doing. So the difference between a ketamine IV drip and you going out to get your hip replaced is it's a fraction of the amount of ketamine that is being administered to you. So it is typically a 0.05% of the amount of ketamine that is given to you under a clinical setting than you would normally receive under a operational setting. And there's a nurse practitioner with you. I can only speak for Sunbelt, but the, personally, what I've read about, it's the same. There's always somebody, there's always a nurse practitioner there with you who is licensed and, certified, and they administer this very low dose of ketamine. Yes, this person goes on a half hour, 45-minute trip, and that's the rub, but that's also where the goodness comes from, because they're able to look at the event or events that are causing them such trauma, and they're able to get out of their own headspace, look at it almost as a detached viewer during this mild psychedelic trip, and they're able to, the words that I've been told, is poof it away. So that's what happens, and the sort of the issue that we're having is ketamine has been off patent for about 20 years now. So that means there's no money to be made from the large pharma, and that's one of the issues. So when Spravato was approved by the FDA about a year ago, the Spravato is uses half of the ketamine molecule, and it really is super expensive. It's more expensive than what Sunbelt would charge for sessions, and it's really literally only half as good. So that's kind of the top overview of the ketamine IV PTSD therapy. But it, as I said earlier, the scores that they take, and forgive me for not knowing the test that it is, but they, if you're at 90, you have thoughts of suicide, you're highly depressed. After one treatment, the scores come way down. It's usually a 2-week to 2-month session where there's a session a week, something like that. The scores come way down, and then they have top-off sessions where it keeps the score low.
That's so pretty dramatic, pretty remarkable change.
It is amazing. And, like a long time ago, once a soldier had endorsed this, once we did our research, went to Sunbelt, talked to the folks that run Sunbelt, they're retired Navy. And, this is their people that they're trying to help. So they are motivated. And they've seen it, but according to Brian, it's that off-patent designation that is kind of what's killing it. And it's, so hopefully that the fact that you can't make money from it, you can make money from it. I don't understand. But I think it's just too squishy right now. The fact that it is kind of the whole acceptance of MDMA and psychedelics and all of those mind-altering drugs are just too squishy for a lot of folks right now.
Right, sure. But in the meantime, this is just one element of what you are presenting. And I want to say this once again, as we're speaking with Dave Barbush, CEO of Once a Soldier, the local organization that provides aid and comfort for veteran suicide families. Mark your calendar now for their Positive Progress Forum on PTSD and Veteran Suicide. It's coming up on Sunday, October 25th at 6 p.m., happening in St. Augustine at the Gourmet Hut. But this will be outdoors and socially distanced, not many seats remaining. Masks are mandatory. So check it out now at onceasoldier.org/events. If you are a veteran family and need this information, this is a really important opportunity. So, Dave, thanks for all you do, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Melissa. It's nice talking to you.
Well, tonight, WJCT, Jacksonville University, and the City of Jax Environmental Protection Board all invite you to join us for a virtual panel discussion on the annual State of the St. Johns River Report. We will have the full report as it's released. We're so excited to get a preview right now from our own reporter, Brendan Rivers, who's moderating tonight's virtual event. Hey, Brendan.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And also on the line, Lisa Reinemann, the St. John's Riverkeeper. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you both. We're excited to partner with everyone involved in this to click on tonight and learn all about the state of the river. Lisa, let's begin with you. This is the 13th annual report that looks at the health, or the lack of it, of the Lower St. John's River Basin. The release is going virtual this year. Give us a preview.
Sure, and thank you. I mean, this is a wonderful report because it's a basically a data clearinghouse. It provides all the information for the Lower St. John's River, and it gives us an opportunity to look at ways that we as citizens can engage to improve the health of the St. John's, celebrate the improvements, but also acknowledge where we still have challenges and where we need to do more working with our elected officials.
And it'll be exciting to have this partnership tonight, Brendan, as we have a lot of important stakeholders joining our forum, our virtual forum, which you'll be moderating, including some members of the City Council and people involved with environmental water quality, plus scientists affiliated with JU. You're going to be covering a lot of ground tonight.
Yeah, that's the plan. We will certainly be covering a range of topics. We'll go over some of the main findings from the report, talk about what that means for the health of the river and for the people who live around it and kind of depend on it. And then we'll talk about some actions that we can take as a community to preserve the river, and that actions that individuals can do as well. And just want to make sure people know there's an event earlier that day, too. That's where the scientists will actually be discussing what they found this year. So that's going to be at 4. Both events, they're free. They will be virtual. You can register for them. Just go online, go to wjct.org/events, and you'll see them both there. Just click the register link, put in your email, and you will get a link to the virtual events.
Okay. And Lisa Reinemann, St. John's Riverkeeper, let's talk about actions everyone can take to protect the health of the St. John's. You know, in this pandemic, other issues that are really quite pressing, public health issues, have sort of fallen a little bit by the wayside. So I'm pleased to be able to shine a light on this because it is important. Educate everyone, if you could, on what we can all be doing to protect this natural resource.
Most definitely. You know, one of the things the report shows us that we still have too much bacteria in our tributaries. And of course, all the rivers, all the creeks in Jacksonville are connected to the St. John's River. And so we really need to be having a detailed community conversation about how we can work to identify problem spots. As we've talked a lot lately, we have too many septic tanks. We have failing septic tanks. We need to work with our local elected officials to make sure that they are going after federal and state resources to make sure we get these septic tanks offline and participate in the conversation, not only to reduce pollution going into our tributaries, into our river, but also to make our community and our rivers and creeks more resilient. And fortunately, there is a very active City of Jacksonville conversation right now that we all can participate in to make sure that we have a stake or a seat at the table.
Sure. Brendan, this will come up tonight. What's exciting about this is that this is going to be a dynamic discussion with people who really know their stuff. You'll have Lisa, you'll have Dr. Quint White from JU's Marine Science Research Institute, Melissa Long, who heads up environmental quality for the City of Jax, City Councilmember Garrett Dennis, and yourself. This is a chance for everyone to listen to those who are on the leading edge of this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is another ADAPT event. We've been doing a lot of them recently, and really the goal with these events is just try to get the most knowledgeable people we can and have these really important conversations so that people can learn about these issues that they may not even realize are very important to their lives. And another big priority for us with these events is making sure we leave time for our audience to directly ask questions to these experts, which is not something many people get to do. I mean, how often do you get to ask a scientist a question, you know? I mean, I get to do it a lot, but most people probably don't. So that's kind of a priority for us. This is a great chance to kind of really ask questions that are important to you that I might not think of, you know?
Yeah, Lisa, this is a chance for anyone who cares about this to interact with all of you. What are some of the most common questions you get asked as the St. John's Riverkeeper?
Sure. We get asked a lot about flooding. Of course, you know, right now we've seen with the high tides flooding on sunny days. And so sea level rise is real. It's happening in our backyard. And also blue-green algae. You know, we haven't had a significant algae outbreak this past year like the green monster we've had in the past. But we have had isolated outbreaks throughout the summer. And so, you know, people are concerned about what they see in their backyard, but also in their parks, in their communities. And they want to know what we can do, like how we can reduce our nutrient pollution footprint. How can we live more resiliency? And those are some of the things we'll be talking about tonight, as well as hoping to start a community conversation where we can go into civic groups and organizations and continue this important conversation.
Yeah. And Brendan, let's take a minute to shine a light on our platform we've created here at WJCT, looking at the issues of climate change, sea level rise, river and estuarine issues. It's adaptflorida.org. You are the lead reporter for that platform.
Yeah, so this has been in existence for a little over a year now. We've kind of shifted gears since the pandemic. We've been doing a lot of these virtual events, and we are now doing a monthly newsletter, so you can subscribe to that. That's at adaptflorida.org. So every month I'm sending an email directly to all of the subscribers with a new in-depth, highly researched story. So next week I'll be releasing a story about St. Augustine, talking kind of about how its economy really depends on its historic resources, and those historic resources are actually severely threatened by sea level rise and flooding. And because the city's economy depends on those resources, it's a critical part of their resiliency strategy. They really need those historic resources to survive, to keep fighting back rising seas. So that's the kind of stuff you'll get if you subscribe to the newsletter. If you go check out adaptflorida.org, you can see all the stories we've done in the past, and you'll also get updates on events like this one. I'm sure we'll be doing more in the future. So that's the kind of work we're trying to do. I think it's very important. I'm really proud of the work we're doing here at WJCT.
Thanks for that. Again, go to wjct.org/events. Still time to register for tonight's forum, Adapt, the state of the St. John's River, as we look at the 13th annual State of the St. John's River report and then have a panel discussion where you, the public, can ask questions. This will be moderated by our own reporter, Brendan Rivers. Panelists are Council Member Garrett Dennis, District 9, Melissa Long, the Environmental Quality Division Chief, City of Jacks, Lisa Reinemann, the St. John's Riverkeeper, and Dr. Quint White of JU's Marine Science Research Institute. We're pleased to partner with JU and the City of Jacks on this important forum. Again, wjct.org/events, and this is tonight. So, Brendan, thank you so much. Also, Lisa Reinemann on the line. Actually, it's Google Hangouts. Both of them giving us this preview. So have a great time tonight. And thank you so much for letting our listeners know this morning.
Thank you,
Melissa.
Thank
you. And thank everyone at WJCT.
A quick break. And in a moment, a new leader and a new generation takes the stage at the City of Jacks Performers Academy. A conversation with Ebony Payne English. That's next. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The first debate was chaos.
The
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court Justice, radical
question,
left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
man? Listen.
The second one was canceled. Now former Vice President Biden and President Trump face off one last time before election night. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join NPR tonight for special live coverage of the presidential debate, plus recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Nina Totenberg, NPR's longtime legal affairs correspondent and a founding mother of NPR. We'll talk about the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings, how Trump has transformed the Supreme Court and the federal appeals courts, and Nina's longtime friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
There is a whole lot of uncertainty surrounding this election, and as you know,
uncertainty is generally really bad for economic activity, and we are going to create an environment of a lot more uncertainty if there's a contested election.
I'm Kai Rizdahl from Small Businesses to Relief Bills, how election uncertainty might hit this economy. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The alphabet has guided the human journey ever since it first started to take shape in the desert of Upper Egypt. From the A to the Z, it's helped order what we know and says something deeper about living life by the letter. Judith Flanders spells it all out in her new book, A Place for Everything, and we'll meet her next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new generation of leadership taking the reins at the Performers Academy in Jacksonville. I learned more from their new executive director, Ebony Payne English. Ebony Payne English, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you're known around town as an art influencer, a poet, an educator. Now you have a new role, taking over from founder Catherine McAvoy as leader, executive director of the Performers Academy. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's very exciting. Catherine McAvoy founded this organization 12 years ago and turned it into a nonprofit with the interest of creating a safe space of self-discovery and artistic expression for the foster youth of Jacksonville, Florida. And then I've been here 5 years, so I came in halfway into her journey, and I teamed up with her because I believed in her mission. I believed in her intentions for the organization, and then we opened ourselves up eventually to the whole community and not just the foster population. We were able to get an after-school programming grant from Kids Hope Alliance, and then she decided that it was time for her to retire and be with her wonderful children and husband, and she trusted me with her passion project and her legacy, and I'm honored to step into the role.
I can't think of a better person. Now, what's so exciting about this is that you have been working for years now with Catherine in St. Nicholas at this full-scale arts academy, and it has been primarily for historically underserved kids. And it's a trauma-informed curriculum for self-expression for children and teens. You have a special approach to help kids heal trauma through art. And you've got diverse programming that you're launching in January, by the way, that I've just heard about. This is called the Squad Goals Teen Studio After School Program. What's going to happen with this?
So Squad Goals Teen Studio, it is the opportunity for us to service the community at large. We do an annual camp. This will be our 10th year. 2021 will be our 10th year of Just Like Me Summer Camp, which is an arts intensive, and it's specifically for the foster youth of Jacksonville, Florida, where they learn 6 different artistic disciplines in 3 weeks with professional artists, providing them 6 hours of programming a day. And then they top it off with a showcase at the Ritz Theater. So we wanted to take that approach because the numbers and the data come back that this works, that this is how kids are processing and working through trauma by being able to not only have access to a therapist, but also have access to an artistic platform where they can dance the things that are unspeakable out, or sing the things that are too complex to talk about out, or write a poem about something that they've just not been able to confront just yet. And so Squad Goals gives us the opportunity to take the curriculum that we use for Just Like Me and open it up to a Monday through Friday after-school program, 2:30 to 6 p.m., in which students all over Duval County can come to our facility, 10,000 square feet, main campus, and a 2,000 square foot black box, and learn the art form, especially at a time like this. So we have plenty of space to socially distance. We have a COVID compliance officer on staff that is regularly and routinely checking to make sure that we're doing everything within our power to keep our kids safe. But it's giving the kids an artistic outlet after the year that they've had. They'll be able to come into our building in January and express themselves, not just in regards to the pandemic and the effect that it's taken on the whole world, but also in regards to what's happening social justice-wise and with the racial tensions in the country, mm-hmm. the place where we accept, our motto is acceptance with no exceptions, where they can experience diversity, inclusion, and representation in very real and applicable situations.
This is such a fantastic opportunity, and enrollment is now open through December. 30 spots available for 30 local kids. Tuition is free. So go now to the website, jaxtpa.org. That's Jax, the Performers Academy, jaxtpa.org. And Executive Director Ebony Payne English, taking over at the Performers Academy. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Thank you for having us on.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield runs our digital operations. Keep those emails coming, meanwhile. Feedback goes to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed any part of today's show, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable and connect with you then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.